First of all.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Jane Kissel, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. And, you know, when I first came here, I heard people say, I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I thought to myself, hey, I'm glad to be here, but I'm not grateful. And my husband, Jack, used to tell a story. And every time he told it, I always thought to myself, that's not an AA story, that's an Al-Anon story. And this, I'm gonna read it, I'm gonna tell it to you and you can decide. O'Malley was a terrible drunk. He threatened his children. He was unkind to his wife. People at work really didn't like him. And O'Malley died. And his wife called up to put his obituary in. And they said, what do you want to say? And she said, O'Malley died. And he said, well, wait a minute, we've got a minimum of 5 words. And she thought for a minute, and she said, O'Malley died, Volvo's for sale. And that's just how I felt when I got to this program. I was, you know, confused and upset. But I'm going to go back and tell you a little bit from the beginning. I was born in Brooklyn, New York. You can tell from the accent. I haven't really lost it. But I was brought up in Amityville, Long Island. And that was, I'm not the Amityville horror, by the way. And I got married when I was young, and I had a little girl when I was 18, and that marriage didn't work. So I moved to New York City with my friend, and it was, you know, I moved to Greenwich Village in New York, and I loved it there, and I got a job, and everything was going along really great. And then I was living in this brownstone house on 12th Street, and I lived in a room in the back of the hall, and this cute guy moved into the room in the front of the hall. And both my daughter, who was 3 at the time, both of us said, boy, is that a cute guy? And we made friends right away. And I have to tell you, the minute I met Jack, he always used to say, and he was probably right about it, I immediately bought 2 cups, 2 saucers, 2 plates, 2 knives, 2 forks, 2 spoons, and he didn't have a chance. And that was true. He did not have a chance. I sort of decided he was mine. And we got along really good. I have to tell you, we went out a lot. We went to all the jazz clubs. My grandmother took care of my daughter, and I had her on weekends. But when I didn't have her, we just had a really good time. Now, every once in a while, Jack would drink a little bit. And that was kind of, you know, I thought, well, you know, everybody does. I did. You know, sometimes I'd have a little bit too much to drink. What was the big deal? And time goes on, as you know. Alcoholism kind of sneaks underneath the door where we live. And it got so that we were living in the village, and we decided that, well, maybe we should get married. And we used to go to this one bar called Louis, and it had this great big long bar. And it had this little guy, and he used to be the bartender. And one day he stood at one end of the bar and yelled up at the other end of the bar and said, when are you gonna make a decent woman out of her? And so Jack looked at me and he said, I think we better get married. And that's what we did, we got married. And it was great. We got my little girl to come and live with us. And we moved into a bigger room in the same house. And we just, you know, everything was going along pretty good. But the drinking kept getting a little bit more. And finally, we were standing on the street one day, I remember, and Jack said, "Exactly what do you want from me?" And I looked at him and I said, he was an actor, and he was going to acting school when he was going to Columbia and to NYU. And I said, "I want you to get a job. That's what I want you to do." Because I was working, but I figured he ought to work too. And he looked at me and he said, "Okay, whatever." And he did. He got a job. He got a job teaching drama at New Rochelle High School. And that was great. We moved to New Rochelle. By this time, I had had my little boy. And John was just the perfect baby. He was just great. And I knew that, you know, Jack was Irish and he was Catholic. And I always figured they had a lot of children. So this ought to really fix things for us. And so we had this little boy and he was so pleased with John. And we moved to New Rochelle and it was just great there. And I figured, you know, things are going good because he was a good teacher and he did a lot of productions and he was very popular, but he drank a lot. And that was always, you know, that was always something that kind of made me think every once in a while. And then I decided, well, you know, I ought to have more children because more children is probably the answer to the whole thing. And so I had our little girl, Christy. And then things went along and we had John and Christy and Kathy and just, you know, things seemed to be okay. But again, the drinking got to be more and more. And finally, Jack came home one day and he said, "You know something? We just had a new girl start work, come into the classroom, and her name is Melinda. Isn't that a beautiful name?" So I had another little girl named Melinda. And I just kept doing those things because I was always trying to make it better. My whole motive always was to make things better for him. Because if I could make him happy, then we would be happy. And all this time I was working. And finally, we decided after I'd had Melinda that maybe I didn't have to work in New York anymore. So, you know, I was home and, you know, it was an interesting time. We loved New Rochelle. I became a Girl Scout leader. And I remember one time going off to, you know, little things happen and you kind of look back on them and you say, "What, you know, something should have told me something was wrong." Because I took Kathy and we went off on a weekend because I was the Girl Scout leader. And when we came home, Jack was taking care of the little children. And when I came in the house, he had put an entire swing set together in the living room. And I kind of looked at it and I said, "You put this whole thing together in the living room? How are you going to get it out?" And he kind of looked at me blankly as if to say, "I don't know." And what he did was he had to take the whole thing apart and take it outside. But those were, you know, those were crazy little things that happened. And we went along and things got, you know, his productions were terrific and the kids loved him. And we would have the parties at our house after the production. And it was just, everything just worked out, you know, seemed to be okay. Except Jack got a job at the radio station and he drank a lot and he lost that job. And then they decided that it, at New Rochelle High School, after you were there for 3 years, you had to get a master's. If you didn't get a master's, you wouldn't be able to keep your job. And so all Jack needed was a point, a class, one class to take. And he said, no, I'm not going to do it. If they want me, let them change the rules. Well, they didn't change the rules. And Jack lost his job. And by this time, I was starting to think, this isn't working. Something's not right. And Jack, he got a job in Ohio directing a community theater. And I thought to myself, well, that's great. Jack goes to Ohio. He directs a theater. I stay in New Rochelle. I take care of the children. I'll get a job again, and that'll take care of everything. I took him to the airport. I said goodbye to him forever. I didn't tell him that. I just said goodbye, and off he went to Ohio. And we had a month that was absolutely marvelous. Everything at home was calm and quiet, and it was just great. And then I got a phone call. I got that usual phone call. And Jack said to me, I need you. Won't you please come? And I said, okay, we'll come. So we packed up, and we only packed the bad necessities, because he said he had a house for us to rent. And we went by train to Ohio. And John had a tooth operated on that morning, and he was not happy. He was feeling badly. Christy was okay. Kathy cried the entire time because she was leaving all her friends behind. And the baby just was absolutely unbelievable. And we had the dog with us because they wouldn't take the dog in the baggage car. And I got off the train in Ohio, and guess who was not there to meet me? You're right, not Jack. Luckily for me, some people from the theater met me. And of course, they were all dressed nice and everything. And I'd spent the whole night on the train with these children and the dog. And they took me to the house that Jack had rented. And it was a great house. Had an upstairs and a downstairs. And it was like a dream house for me. I just loved it. And finally, Jack got home and he gave me a long story about how he had this meeting and he couldn't go. And I found out when he got to Alcoholics Anonymous that he had actually stopped to get one drink on his way to the train station and just forgot about coming to pick us up. And I said, okay, I understand. And he knew that I knew, and I knew that he knew, but we just passed it off. And Jack was great in Lima, Ohio. It was a wonderful theater, brand new. It was just a really nice place to be. And we had friends on our block, and it just looked like maybe this was the answer. And Jack directed some plays and everybody loved them. And it was just, things again, I thought, well, maybe things are getting a little bit better. But of course, alcoholism doesn't work that way. It didn't take any time at all till things got back to where they had been before. And I remember Jack used to drink a lot, and drinking really didn't frighten me because I was used, drinking wasn't a big deal. I remember at home when I was growing up, my grandmother and great-grandmother brought me up, and I think there was one bottle of whiskey in the house the whole time I was growing up. It was used for New Year's Eve, and it was used to take any time you had a toothache or a tummy ache or something, you got a little bit of whiskey and water. And that was the extent of drinking. So I didn't know anything about alcoholism, but alcohol really didn't scare me as much. Because when I was in New York, I was drinking with him and we got along real good at it. You know, there was no problem. But all of a sudden in Ohio, Jack started to use pills and things like that. There was a pharmacy school at the college that we went to after he lost his job directing that theater, which was a big disappointment to me because I really liked being there and I loved the house and all that. But when he lost his job there, he got a job teaching at Ohio Northern University, and he was teaching drama. And it was a really good job. He was making more money than he had made at the community theater. And things were just, you know, I thought, well, you know, this is a little town. You know, it was such a small town that everybody knew everybody. And I thought, well, you know, maybe this will do it. Maybe this is the right place to be. And so we moved there, and things went along just like they always did. And of course, by this time, you know, we had four children, and it was a tough time because I think, you know, he used to get paid. I think at that time he got paid $400 a month, and we would go once a month and get all these groceries and so on. And we were all set for a month, and it was good. And we seemed to be, you know, things seemed to be okay. But then Jack started making some friends. He would go back to Lima, Ohio, and there was a poet that he made friends with. And I remember this poet had a motorcycle, and Jack would come roaring in at 2 a.m. on this motorcycle with his friend. And, you know, it just slowly things got worse and worse. And finally, the same thing happened in Ohio, that in Ada, Ohio, that had happened, and in Lima, Ohio. They just loved his work. It was just good work, but they couldn't stand the person. And so we finally decided, but while we were in Ohio, I remember it was when Martin Luther King Jr. was shot, and Jack was directing a play with his nephew in the play. And I remember that whole thing going on. And we had also had a thing when Martin Luther King had come to the college to speak. And the president of the college would not meet with him. And so we had a party for him after he spoke. And, you know, so our life was starting to, you know, to change, and things were getting more and more that we were used to doing things. And, but when he lost that job, he said to me, where do you want to go now? Well, I darn well did not want to go back east again where everybody knew us. And so he had been to California. And so he said, why don't we go to California? We'll go to Los Angeles, because that was close to Hollywood, because that was what was in his mind. Because all the time that he was directing, he always wanted to be acting. And so we said, okay, great. We'll go to California. And now I decided that I would send my children by plane to some friends of ours were out here that we had worked with at the school. And then I found out I was going to put them two and two into a plane. But then I found out if they all went with Kathy, who was of age then, that everybody could go, you know, much cheaper and much better. So I put all my children on one plane and I just prayed, oh God, please let my babies get to the other end. And they did. And Jack and I packed up this old Chevy car that we had. And we didn't send very much furniture because it cost too much money. So we got everything together. And we stopped off in Chicago to see a student of his, because they had a pharmacy school at the college, and they used to bring him all these pills and all these things. And I remember one time we had a coffee table, and this one student came in and he put all these pills out on the coffee table, and he said, Mr. Kissel, I have no idea what they are. And Jack scooped them all up and swallowed them, and I couldn't believe it. And he said, I'll let you know. And oh boy, that was not a pleasant thing. But we stopped off, and this fellow, his father owned a drugstore, and they were selling hammocks. And I thought, gee, I ought to get a couple of hammocks. The girls could sleep in hammocks when we get to Los Angeles. I mean, sailors sleep in hammocks, why not? And so we bought the hammocks and we packed them in the car and we started across the country. And I did most of the driving. By this time, Jack had long hair. He had a mustache. He was on his way to being a hippie. He always insisted he was not a hippie, but believe me, he was a hippie. And we started across the country, mostly me driving. And when we'd get to any kind of population, he was nervous about them seeing him. And see, I didn't know that he was drinking all the time and using all the time. It just went over my head. I just didn't notice it. You know how we do. We had a meeting the other night on denial, and I was full of denial. And so every time we'd get near any kind of population, Jack would sit underneath the passenger seat. Well, you know, if you don't know about alcoholism and you're driving the car, and all of a sudden you're looking at your husband sitting on the floor and you start to think to yourself, what's going on with him? You know, and I thought, you know, I'm not so sure. He may need more help than I can give him. And I couldn't figure out, should I put him where his mother is so she can watch him? Or should I put him where I am so I can watch him? And these are the things that were going through my head. And I decided, you know something? When I get to Los Angeles, I'm going to get a job and I'm getting rid of Jack. And that's when I started constantly for the next 10 years, getting rid of Jack. I never got rid of him, but I was always going to get rid of him. And we finally got out here and we came because he was very smart. We didn't come across the desert, because if we'd done that, I would have said, oh, this is all, I don't like this at all. But instead we came through San Francisco and down the coast, and I fell in love with this place. Of course, I was kind of angry at San Francisco because we met some people there and Jack got in a fight in the park. And my thing always was, when he would get into a fight with something, I just take the car and leave. Well, I was scared to death in San Francisco because those hills are more than I was brought up on flat ground. And Jack got in this fight. And finally, though, we got down here to Los Angeles. And our friends lived in Long Beach, but they'd gotten an apartment for us in Silver Lake. So we moved to Silver Lake, and gosh, it was the whole top of an old house. And our living room, the few things that we had were all at one end of the room. And the rest of the room was empty because we didn't have that much furniture. And our daughter had a bedroom. Jack and I had a red room. The girls had a room. And that's when I put the hammocks up. And at first, all you heard at night was bam, bam, as one kid would fall out, then the other one. So we finally got rid of the hammocks and got them beds to sleep in. And John slept at one corner of the great big dining room. So, you know, it was a nice place. And it was, you know, I remember one time I got home and my little girls were downstairs with umbrellas and they had the thing for the water for the, you know, the ironing. And they were sprinkling onto their umbrellas. And I said, what do you girls miss the rain? And they said, yeah, we really do miss the rain. But it was, you know, and I remember when this place had 58 stairs to go up. So boy, if you went shopping and you forgot something, forget it. Nobody was going to go down and get it. And it was a nice place to be. And I got a job. At that point, Jack, this was going to be the last 3.5 years of Jack's drinking. And of course, we didn't know that. But at that point, he wasn't well. He was feeling kind of out of it. And the only thing he really was able to do was to get up in the morning, get the newspaper, and circle jobs for me. And finally, I got a job and I worked up on Wilshire Boulevard. And it was one of these things where if you took a bus to get there, it would take you 3 buses. And, you know, so I said, no, we only had one car. If you don't pick me up and you don't take me to work, I'm not going to stay there. And so he would come and pick me up, but he was always late doing it. And I had to get home and feed the children. And, you know, life got to be, you know, really, really at loose ends with us. And he was doing the same thing. He was still drinking a lot, but he really wasn't well. And so he, you know, we just let him, you know, we let him, you know, kind of, I don't know, I just let go of him. And he would go out at night and then finally get home late in the morning. And it was just, you know, life was really not, it was not the kind of thing that a family should have. And finally, I got a job working at a publishing company. And I got this job and I loved it. It was a great job. I was working in production and so on, but it was in Hollywood. And I drove to work and I went by this one house and it had a for rent sign. And I stopped and I talked the woman into renting us this house. We had no money, nothing, but I just talked her into it. One of the things was if we kept her dogs, because she was going to move into an apartment and couldn't take the dogs and she would, you know, and everything. So we got this house up in Hollywood. And I just figured, again, my whole obsession was with Jack. You know, I'm moving Jack up to Hollywood where he drinks. So now he won't have to travel so far to get to Silver Lake. And so that was, you know, that was my motive. And I loved my job and I was close enough. I was like 5 minutes away from work. The children went to school and if they did something at school, I was able to go and see it because I just arranged my lunch hour so I could do that. And, you know, things on my side got a little bit more calm. And, but Jack was getting worse and worse. He used to hang around in this one bar called J. Sloan's. And I was so irritated with him because he never came home. So I started sending his mail. I just forwarded his mail to Jay Sloan's. And he'd come home and say, I went for a beer and they gave me my mail. Why do you do things like that? And I had to remember those kind of things when I got to the program and I got to that second step. And finally it just got more and more. And by this time, Jack was truly, truly a hippie. He had long hair, a Fu Manchu mustache. He had a flowered shirt he used to wear. He alternated two pair of pants. One was a red and black brocade. The other one was a gold brocade with bell bottoms. And he carried a shoulder bag. And he was always out and always drinking and hardly ever home. He always used to tell a story about he would sit in the bar and talk about his wonderful children, and he hadn't seen them for 3 days. But you know, that's the Irish guy, that's the way they do it. And finally, he got arrested one night, and he was at the West Hollywood jail, and he had told some kid to call me and tell me he was in jail. And I always looked pretty, you know, pretty normal. I worked in an office, and so I went down to try to bail him out. Now, remember, that was before program. I went down to bail him out of jail. And when I got there, Jack had caused a good deal of trouble when they arrested him. And they took a look at me, and they decided they weren't going to be too helpful. And the jailer said, I don't think your husband is here. I said, yes, I know he is. They told me he was there. And I said, and they said, no, I don't think so. I don't think your husband is here tonight. And I said, oh, yes, he is. That's his purse laying right over there. And so they said, okay, he is, but we're not going to let him go. And so I went home. And I got a call at 6 a.m. and Jack said he was out of jail. And I said, fine, where are you? I'll come and get you. He said, no, I'll walk home myself. And I said, okay. And I got the children up and they went off to school. And I was just leaving for work when Jack got home. And this was the first time I had been trying to get rid of him for years. I had, you know, ever since we got to Los Angeles, I've been trying just to get rid of him. And I'd say to my oldest daughter, you know, Kathy, tonight we're getting rid of Daddy. This is too much. We can't handle it. And she said, okay, Mom, I'll help you with the children. And then he would come home the next day with a poem, a rose, some flowers, and tell me everything was going to be different. And I said, okay, that's fine. We'd go places. We used to go to the Troubadour all the time. And he'd make such a fuss there that I'd just leave and drive home. And he said to me, you've got to stop leaving me all over Los Angeles. And I just didn't pay much attention to what I was doing. And so that night, that morning when he walked in, for the first time, I really meant it. I said, Jack, we can't do this anymore. Your children deserve better, and I deserve better. And I didn't care if I had to go live in a room with my children. I didn't care what happened. I knew that we couldn't live like this anymore. And I said, Jack, I'm going to come back at lunchtime. If you're not gone, I'm going to call the police. And I went to work. And that's when the miracle started to happen. I went to work and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous and I made a phone call. I got a woman at the other end of the phone and I told her about Jack and we talked about him. And she said, well, you know, you can go home and ask him if he wants help. And if he wants help, here's a telephone number for him to call. And we decided that, she said, there's a lot of places closer, but up in Oxnard, there's Serenity Manor. And if you go up, if you take him up there, at least he won't beat you home. So we decided that if he did decide to go, I would take him up to Oxnard. And I got home at lunchtime, and of course, he was passed out. Well, I didn't know about blackouts. I didn't know about passing out. I didn't know about any of these things that have to do with alcoholism. And I finally got him awake. And I remember him telling me that one time his mother had to throw water on him to wake him up. And I thought, what a terrible thing. But I was just about ready to do that. And finally he woke up and I said, Jack, do you want help? And he looked at me and he said, yes. And I said, okay, I've got this number for you to call. And I dialed the phone and handed it to him. And I heard him talking. And he's, yes, he said, okay, yes. And, you know, he hung up the phone and he said, would you drive me up to Oxnard? And I would have driven him over Laurel Canyon if he wanted anything. And I said, sure, I will drive you there. And at that time, he was directing a play, The Tempest, for the Shakespeare Society. And the children were in the play, and it was, you know, and he was drinking a lot, and they were seeing a part of him that was very upsetting. And I knew that this was the right thing to do. And so I drove him up to Oxnard, and all the way up there, his father was an Alcoholics Anonymous, and his father was not a pleasant person, even sober. And we discovered later on that he never was really sober a lot of the time. But all Jack remembered was his father going to AA and not being very nice. And he says, if this has anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't want anything to do with it. And I kept saying, I don't know, which I didn't. I didn't know what it was. And we got up there and we went in and Bud was there. I'll never forget Bud, because Bud sat us down and Bud told us what it used to be like, what had happened, and what it was like for him now. And Jack listened and Jack said, I'll stay. And I said, okay. And he was going to stay for a week. And I said, okay. And I got out of there really quick. And I got back to LA. And I took the children over to the play because they were performing then. And he had told me, be sure and tell them I had a nervous breakdown. And I said, okay, sure. So I went there and I said, oh, Jack had a nervous breakdown. And everybody laughed at me because everybody knew what his problem was. And but I didn't know, I didn't realize it. And so we went, and I had promised that woman on the phone when I was talking to her, she had asked me about Al-Anon and I didn't know about it. And she said, here's the telephone number for Al-Anon. Promise me that you will go to Al-Anon. And I said, yes, I will. And I made her that promise. And so Jack was up there. He went up on a Monday. And on Wednesday, I had a call from him and he sounded different. It was like a whole difference in his voice. And he said, I'm going to my first AA meeting tonight. He said, are you going to go to Al-Anon? And I said, yes, I am. And I called and I found out that there was a meeting on Melrose, which was right around the corner from where we lived. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting on Friday night. And I walked in and a woman walked up to me and she said, who's the problem drinker you're coming to Al-Anon for? And I said, my husband. That's the first time I ever said it. And I sat through that meeting, and I couldn't believe those people. They knew how I felt. I could hear it in their voice. I could hear what they were saying. And after the meeting, she said, the same woman said to me, "Do you have any children at home?" I said, "Yes, my oldest daughter's gone, but I still have 3 children at home." She said, "They go to Alateen." I said, "Okay, what is it and where is it?" And she told me. And that was on Friday night. On Saturday, I made my first Al-Anon call. And I said, "We're going to go up and see my husband tomorrow. What should I say? What should we do? What should I tell the children?" And she said, "Jean, just go." And I said, "Okay, I will." And we went up there, and I found out, I thought Jack was going to stay another week, but he said he was coming home with us. And they had packed a picnic lunch for us and told us to go to Ojai and to have a picnic. And they explained to Jack that he should tell us about him and what he'd been through and what the promises he was going to make. And he did. And it was, you know, they said, "Don't tell the children what to say." And my youngest one was 7. And he told us all about being a drinking and how he was going to stop and all of this. When he got all finished, this little face looked up at him and said, "What, Dad, you're trying to tell me you're a drunk? And, you know, did you want to hit a kid?" Yep. We came home, we brought him home. And that was on Sunday. And on Tuesday, we went to the Arlington meeting. And the children and Jack and I, and Jack went to the AA meeting downstairs. I went to Al-Anon upstairs. I opened up the Alateen door and I pushed John in, and the sponsor yelled out at me, "Is he 12? I said, "Of course." I shut the door, and he was only 11. And the girls went to the preteen meeting, and we did that for 2 years. But that was also my first amends that I had to make, because I told them what had happened, and they said, "You have to go and tell that sponsor that he's 11, and he won't be 12 until September." And I did, and the kids all took a vote, and they said that John could stay, because I knew he wouldn't stay if he went with the girls. And that's how we started this program. We went to that meeting, and I started taking the children to other Alateen meetings, and I started going to Al-Anon meetings, and our whole life was program. We didn't do anything but go to meetings. We did do one thing on Saturday night. Jack's sponsor had suggested we go to the Malibu meeting, and we did that. We went to Malibu every Saturday night, and that was a wonderful thing. We never talked to each other going to the meeting, because I was still angry at him, and but coming home, we would talk, because we'd talk about the speaker. And I went to Al-Anon, and I was determined that I was going to divorce Jack, because I'd had it. And they told me, "No, we don't make emotional decisions for the first 6 months." And I went to the meetings. I went home, and I marked my calendar for 6 months. And but somewhere along the way, those 6 months, I changed my mind. And I decided, you know, between my sponsor and his sponsor, what we're going to try and do is make a go of it. Because they told me, do everything you can to make it work. If it doesn't, then it's okay to stop. But first, work at trying to make it work. And so we did. Jack and I worked our programs, both of us. And we worked, both of us had wonderful sponsors. Jack's sponsor, I remember Fred saying, Al-Anons are the most loving people in the world, but that love is often misdirected. And that's what I had done all those years. I always did the things that I thought was going to make it better, but they were all wrong. They were the wrong things to be doing. And so that love was misdirected. And I worked at, you know, my sponsor taught me, she taught me how to be a wife. I didn't know how to be a wife. All I knew was to yell and scream and criticize. I didn't know that you could love somebody and be and have, you know, a good relationship with them. She taught me how to be a mother. I didn't know how to be a mother because I'd been obsessed with an alcoholic all the years that I'd had those children. And so I started working the program. But first I read the steps for Jack, but then I realized I was going to have to work the steps. And I started to do it. I didn't have any trouble with the first step when it came to believing I was powerless over alcohol, because I knew I was by that time. But my life is unmanageable. It didn't seem, I had a job, we had a house, we had all these things. And my sponsor said, well, let's talk about it. And it turns out we were 3 months behind in the rent. The house was a mess, but you can't get anybody to fix it if you're 3 months behind in the rent. And my job, I was almost ready to lose that job because I had spent so much time on the phone trying to find Jack for the last 3 years. And so, you know, my job was in jeopardy. The children were a mess. And everything was wrong, and I could admit that my life was unmanageable. And I got to the second step, and I realized, you know something? This is Jack's problem, not my problem. And then I started to remember forwarding his mail. I started to remember chasing around at night. I used to wake the children up, put them in the car, take them to look for Jack. I didn't want Jack. I just wanted to know where he was. And then take him home, put him back to bed, and wake him up to go to school. And those were the kind of things I did. And those were not sane things. And so I could work that second step. And I love the third step. The third step has made such a difference in my life. I could turn my will and my life over to, because by this time, I had worked with my sponsor and found out that there was a power greater than me, that I was not God, but there was a power greater than me. And I could turn my will and my life over. And I did the fourth step. I did a wonderful fourth step. I really wrote it out. I even sat at the museum and wrote, you know, I just, you know, this was a great fourth step. And I did the fifth step with my sponsor. And there were things like, I talked about this dollhouse that I had that I just loved. I think I played with that dollhouse until I was ready to get married. And I just loved it. And my sponsor said, who gave you that dollhouse? And I said, my mother. And I didn't like my mother. Because my mother, I figured she didn't want me. I never lived with her. She had remarried, had a baby, and I never lived with my mother. But all of a sudden, I could see she furnished that house for me. She was there for me as much as she could be. And I was also angry at my father. He had promised to send me to college. And when it got time to do it, he said, you know, you better take the secretarial course. And he didn't send me to college. And I knew if that man had sent me to college, I'd be living on the Riviera. I'd have a home in Paris. I'd be living in New York. You know, everything would be different. That man had let me go to college. And so I was angry with him. And I talked about in my fourth step about my bicycle and how I rode all over in it. And my sponsor said, "Where did you get that bicycle?" And I said, "My father." And I stopped hating my father because I realized that that man did the best he could. And then I did the rest of the fifth step with her. And that was a wonderful experience. And I got to six and seven. Well, six and seven, that really worked because, you know, when you do that, you see all of the, there's the defects of character. And I've worked on my shortcomings. And I thought, oh boy, and I worked on them. And my sponsor promised me, "You work on six and seven, and we will take all of the negatives and turn them into positives." And I said, okay. And there was one where I was trying to manage everything at home. And she said, "You know, instead of managing everything at home where they're not interested in it, why don't you do it at work?" And remember, I was having trouble at work, and I started doing it. And 6 months later, I got a plaque that said Gene Kissel, manager. And that was great. It really worked. And so, you know, I worked on six and seven. And, you know, every once in a while, I have to go back and re-look at six and seven, but I worked on them. And eight, I made my list of people. I had a big, long list, and my sponsor cut it down. And then I made my other list in three columns, and I started making the amends. And some of them were simple, and some of them weren't. My grandmother had passed away, who had brought me up, and I wrote a letter to her. But I worked on eight and nine, and I got them done. And then I got to the 10th step. And the 10th step, I just love the 10th step because it says promptly admit. So every night I stop and I say, okay, what happened today? Was I rude to anybody? Did I get impatient? When I was working, I'd say, did I help? Did I do the right thing? And each day I went over my day. And that's such a blessing to get it. Because if you don't do it promptly, you end up back at the ninth step again. And I had no desire to go back there. And then on the 11th step, pray for God's will for you and the power to carry it out. I spend every morning, the first thing I do is remind myself that my higher power has my will in my life, and that today, whatever happens to me, it's God's will for me, and I can carry it out. I remember tripping over one of those bars that in the, you know, where they parked the car, and I broke my shoulder. And I remember laying on the cement, and I couldn't move because I knew I'd done something, you know, that really hurt. And I thought, okay, I don't know what happened, but this is your will for me. Just help me carry it out. And that's the way I worked the 11th step. And the 12th step is so important to me because it's that spiritual awakening. And there's a story that goes with it. Jack sponsored a fellow named John. And John had a wife, Patty, and Patty had a brain tumor. And John couldn't leave her alone very much. But I took her to meetings and took her home. And I worked with her as best I could. And when she would ask me things, I never knew whether it was the brain tumor or the new Al-Anon that was talking. But we got along okay. And we were going to go to Bakersfield to the convention. And John called Jack and said, "I can't go because Patty won't go and I can't leave her home alone." And Jack turned to me and he said, "Gene, go over and talk Patty into going to Bakersfield." And I thought, I don't think I'm supposed to do that. I was just about 3 years on the program. I said, I don't think I'm supposed to do that to myself. And I thought, I don't know. If my sponsor finds out, I'm going to be in trouble. But I went over and I talked to Patty and I explained to her how nice Bakersfield was. I loved going to Bakersfield. It was great. And she decided she would go. So we got up to Bakersfield and John called Jack and said, I can't come to the lunch because Patty won't go and I can't leave her alone. And so Jack said, Gene, go and talk Patty into going to the lunch. And I thought, well, my sponsor's back here in LA and I'm in Bakersfield. I don't think anybody will tell on me. So I'll go over and talk to Patty. And I talked her into going. I said, it's a big, long table because they did it family style. They put all the food on the table. And I said, John can sit on the other side of Jack. And then I'll sit. And then you can sit next to me. And you won't even have to talk to John if you're mad at him. And she said, okay, she'd go to lunch. And at lunch, Ramona was the speaker. And Ramona's was a wonderful, wonderful Al-Anon. And she talked about her trip in Al-Anon, but she also talked about having a brain tumor. She talked about the medicine she had to take, and she talked about all of that. And when she was done, after everybody talked to her, I went up to her and I said, Patty is down there and she's got a brain tumor. Would you talk to her? And Ramona went down and talked to Patty. And I watched it, and I was standing on the side with another alcoholic. And Milton said to me, watch the hand of God at work. And that for me was a spiritual awakening, because I could see that what we do for each other, what the things that we feel, and what we share with each other is the thing that makes our program. And that was a wonderful thing to happen. And, you know, I've worked a lot on this program. I've sponsored people and I love that most of all. I sit at home here and the phone rings all the time. Someone asked Jack once how could he stand it with all the phone calls? And he said, you know, if the phone calls stop, I stop too. And that's the way I feel. I love those phone calls and I love the people that I work with. I love this program. This program has changed my life. It has made a person out of me that I wanted to be. I never wanted to be that screaming, awful person that, you know, when we first got here, Jack was very upset with my language. And I talked to my sponsor about it and she said, just stop doing it. And I did. But, you know, we changed so much here. And working this program and loving it, you know, today, I say, I am a grateful member of Al-Anon, and I mean that because I am so grateful for every person that I come in contact with and every person that I've known on this program, and I've loved it. I sponsored Al-Ateen Preteen for 12 and a half years, and I learned about my children through that. And I learned how to be a wife, and I learned how to be a mother. I learned how to live a life that I wanted to live. And it's all because of you people and how you were always there for me. And God willing, I will always be there for you. Thank you.